Okay, folks, welcome to the March 2nd Q&A. Welcome to anybody who's new to us here this evening. We do welcome guests at any time at any of our meetings, and Q&A is certainly no different. We are recording the audio, and the audio recording along with the deck and the contents of the chat window will be going up on the website later on. If you want to comment or ask a question, you can do so in the chat window, or if you want, you can unmute yourself. Please remute yourself afterwards so we don't have too much background noise going on. And with that, I'll pass it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Take it away, Alan.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris, and I will kick off by saying that we have a lot of information for you tonight in various categories. However, once we've got through tonight, as it says here, the cupboard will be bare. You probably realize that we've had a number of people giving series and reviews of different applications and various shares. Although tonight Bob Walker is going to finish off his series on internet privacy, there are no Android apps from Tom or Stuart in the pipeline, and Chris and I don't have anything really prepared right now. So it's over to you people. We basically need some questions about your computer problems that members might be able to solve, shares of mini presentations, as you'll see tonight, you'll see some shares on anything that's computer related that you think would be, that interests you and you think would be of interest to somebody else. And also, remember our computer basics sessions. If there's any kind of technique or task in Windows or one of the other operating systems that we cover, Android, Linux, that you would like to know about, certainly we can try and provide information on those kind of things too. So if you have specific questions or things that you'd like to share or request about computer basics, send it along to the suggestion box and we'll fill that up with things to do in the next week or so. And so speaking of shares, we're going to start off with a share from our friend Chris.
Yeah, so any security company worth their salt puts out an annual cybersecurity report, and Reason Labs is no different. They're the people who actually started a giant anti-spyware, which eventually was bought by Microsoft and turned into Microsoft Security Essentials, which turned into Windows Defender, which turned into Microsoft Defender. So it has a long history, this company. And it was kind of an interesting report. It's consumer cybersecurity, so I thought it'd be more interest to, you know, people like us rather than, you know, corporate security or something like that. Some of the key findings I found were kind of interesting. It's year of the miner. Was 2021. 58% of all Trojan software out there were crypto miners. So crypto miners are those ones that you get it onto your computer, it'll use your computer to mine crypto coins to the benefit of somebody else other than you. And so it's chewing through your electricity, keeping your computer going, and hampering the performance of your computer for what you want it to do. They said there was a really sharp rise in that crypto jacking, which is infecting computers to do crypto mining and info stealing. Force phishing through documents and email was still really popular for getting malware out there. So don't click those, open those attachments that you get into your email. One of the most prevalent detections was adware browser modifiers. So these are ones that will modify your browser settings so that you open up in places that are going to inject advertising into your browser, and somebody else is going to get paid to have you look at ads. They had a little bit of forward-thinking stuff, which is interesting. 2022, they thought that there would be a shift in hacker focus away from companies and going back to consumers. And I thought that was really interesting because enterprises is where the money is, really, certainly in terms of locking up computers and demanding ransom. Enterprises are, you know, they can come up with millions of dollars, whereas you and me, if we're going to come up with anything, it's going to be considerably less. They still think cryptojacking is going to continue to increase, and they thought that young consumers are going to be more at risk as there will be malware and cracks, games, cheats. They think that's going to increase significantly. So the URL to the report is there. I also pasted that into the chat. You are asked for an email address and a name, but you can put in anything. As soon as you put in something, it'll immediately give you the report. So you can put in fake information if you want at that point.
Okay, thanks, Chris. It sounds like we should have made a complete backup of the system last week.
Sorry.
Everybody's going to make a backup now to avoid these crypto hacking.
Yes, that'd be a good thing.
Okay, next on the list is a question that came in last week from Orion. He's interested in keyloggers or how to avoid keyloggers. And he points out that most antivirus programs will detect keyloggers, but how else can you make sure that there isn't a keylogger installed on your system, because that can steal information? So he says, how do you do that beyond trying to use Task Manager, which is a bit complicated, as I think Chris is going to point out.
Yeah, it's interesting because I started this off when the question came in, and I thought, oh yeah, I could put together a slide on that, you know, it's no big deal. And then you start going down a rabbit hole. And so it's a little bit more complex than what I originally just thought off the top of my head. First off, what is a keylogger? So a keylogger is software or hardware, but typically software, where it'll record the keystrokes that you are typing on your keyboard, and it could be anything. And everything, so including passwords as you type them in, logging out of sites, credit card numbers as you enter them in and you're buying things, stuff like that. So typically the user will not be aware that their keystrokes are being recorded and picked up by somebody else. Keyloggers can be hardware or software. I pasted into the chat this link to a Wikipedia page, which does a pretty good job of talking about keystroke logging and what it's all about. So I have one slide on hardware keystroke loggers, and that'll be it for keystroke loggers. So next slide. So a hardware keystroke logger is something that you insert the keyboard plug into it, and then it into the computer. So it sits in between your keyboard and your computer. So obviously it can actually record all the keystrokes because it's just passing them through. The attacker can retrieve the log later, or in the event of something like this one that you see on the screen here, they can actually stream it over Wi-Fi. So this AirDrive keylogger actually has Wi-Fi capability on it. The defense for these is really just visual examination. You have to look and see, is there something in between your keyboard cable and the computer? And so if you look at down at the bottom left, you know, they're pretty shameless in saying what this is all about. Monitoring employee productivity, monitoring anybody's productivity is really the thing. Observe World Wide Web, email, and chat usage. And for investigators, monitoring remote computers, and then retrieving unknown passwords. And it's operating system independent, obviously, because it's just recording the keystrokes. Some of the features of this one in particular, it's got 16 megabytes worth of internal flash memory, so you could record up to 16 million keystrokes, essentially. It does work as a Wi-Fi hotspot, so the person doesn't have to come back and retrieve the physical device. They can just, you know, do it remotely over Wi-Fi, or you can have it send email reports with the recorded keystrokes. That's really all I have to say about hardware keyloggers. They do require physical access to the device to put it in, but as you can see from this one, not all of them will require physical access to collect the data from them. So now let's get on to software keyloggers. So Orion noted that most antivirus programs will detect keyloggers. The key thing there is that if they're known, because most antivirus programs operate on a detective known mode. So it's known signatures of malware that it's going to detect. If you get some brand new piece of malware that the antivirus company hasn't seen before, they're not going to detect it. So question then becomes, you know, what can be done to detect keystroke loggers? So there's two ideas that I came up with that I thought of, and if anybody has any other ideas, by all means, chime in. So another antivirus program installed on your computer might detect more things than the one that you have. So the key point on antivirus programs is that no one antivirus program is going to detect all malicious software. So a double check with, you know, a second, third, fourth, whatever antivirus program is more likely to ferret out all instances of it. The other one is Task Manager, as Orion noted, and I'll talk more about that. So talking about antivirus programs, you should only have one, what is known as on-access antivirus program. This is the program that is constantly running on your computer from the time you boot it up until the time you shut it down, and it watches as files are being either written to disk or read from disk, and it can also do checks on things that exist only in memory, but basically it's checking things on disk. And then if a file is going to be accessed either for read or write, it swoops in, checks out the file, and if it deems it to be non-malicious, will allow the normal operation to continue. Otherwise, it'll block it. If you have two on-access antivirus programs installed, because they are trying to swoop in and get access to it before anything else, they're going to fight to get first access. The performance of your computer goes down into the toilet. There are some specially designed antivirus programs that can operate alongside of existing antivirus program. An example of that is Malwarebytes. It's the only one I know of that does this. Generally speaking, when you install an on-access antivirus program, it will look for anything else that is an on-access antivirus program and disable it. Sometimes silently, sometimes politely, and say, oh, you've got this, do you want us to disable it? Next build. So although you can only have one or should only have one on-access antivirus program, you can have multiple on-demand antivirus programs. And an on-demand program is something that you just tell it, okay, go and check this file, this folder, this drive, this computer, and it will go and it'll open up all of the files. And the reason why it can work in conjunction with an on-access antivirus program is that the on-demand antivirus program goes to open up a file. The on-access antivirus comes in, says, oh, I have to check it first. It'll go, it'll open it, it'll check it, and if it's deemed to be non-malicious, it'll pass it on to the on-demand antivirus program, and the on-demand antivirus program will then scan it. So no problem at all running an on-demand antivirus in addition to on-access. Next slide. And I'm pasting this into the chat window as well. So there are a lot of free on-demand antivirus programs around. So I list a bunch here. Some of them you go to a website and you actually initiate a scan from the website. Some of them it's software that you do download and install onto your computer and then you just run it locally. So there's a whole bunch of them. Feel free to check out any or all of them and try them out and see. I find them good to be, if you think that for some reason maybe your on-access antivirus program is not doing a complete job, you can run these other ones periodically and just see if they happen to pick up something. Why do these companies give it away for free? They're hoping that they'll find something that your antivirus program failed to pick up, and then you'll say, oh, maybe I'll switch to them for their on-access product, which typically does cost money. So the next one is using Task Manager to sleuth out things. So the idea behind using Task Manager is that you want to find unknown or suspicious programs that are running on your computer and eliminate them. So just a recap of last week, I talked about using Task Manager for another purpose. And so how do you get to Task Manager? Press Control Shift Escape, we'll load it. You can right click a blank area of the taskbar and you'll get a context menu pop up and choose Task Manager. You can press Control-Alt-Delete, which will give you a blank screen with box in the middle with a number of options, one of which is Task Manager. Choose that. Or you can press the Start button, start typing in Task Manager. It'll pop up as in the best match at the top of the search list, and just click on that, and that'll start Task Manager. So First thing you have to do if you've never used Task Manager before is configure how it displays, because by default, it will come up similar to this, where it's just listing all of the visible programs on your computer. Well, malware will never be a visible window, so they will always run it as a hidden window. So if you click on the more details, you will get on the left-hand side all processes, and then on the right-hand side, you'll get metrics about that. So performance of each of those in terms of memory, CPU, disk, network access, and GPU access. And you have sortable columns for all of that. What you're really interested in is that all processes. Now, when you get that view come up, if you right-click on the anywhere in the header bar, you'll get a context menu come up, and you can choose command line. And that will add command line to the list of columns that are available to you. So here we are seeing it where we've added the command line to Task Manager. I typically, if I'm doing something like this, I'll click on the top of the name column so that it sorts it by name. If you sort by, say, CPU utilization, your list is going to jump all over the place. So just to have a static list that I find sorting by name usually makes sense. Then you want to look to see where the process is actually loading from. Remember, we're trying to find suspicious processes, so programs that you didn't install on your computer that maybe a hacker managed to get installed on your computer somehow. So what I say is concentrate on background processes. You actually have apps, which are those visible windows. You have background processes, and then you'll have Windows processes. Typically, Windows processes are pretty safe. They're all signed digitally. They're protected by the operating system to a great extent and so forth. So in all likelihood, most malware is going to end up showing up in the background processes area of the list. So what I do then is I start looking at the names. So I see ACC SVC. So ACC service is probably what it is. I don't know what that is. So I'll need to look into that a little bit further. I go down a little bit further in the list, and I see CCleaner. Well, CCleaner is a program that I installed. It's probably okay. I'll probably do some other checks on it as well. But that's how I start, is looking at those names of the processes and see if I recognize them. So then I look at, you know, that ACC SVC, and I'll look at the command line. Is the command line something I would recognize or expect? So in this case, ACC SVC is loading from C program files x86, Acer Care Center, and then ACC SVC.exe is the actual program that is running. So this was run on an Acer computer. So it's not all that unusual for me to see something like that, that, oh, okay, the manufacturer, they have this thing called Care Center, and, you know, they built in, you know, a hierarchy in the program files directory called Acer. It makes sense, you know. So it's not likely that malware would end up in that particular directory. You know, a malware author isn't going to know that I've got an Acer computer. And so they're not going to purposefully put it into there in all likelihood. It's not impossible, but I think it's not likely that this is malware. So some entries that you'll see there will have a chevron to the left of them. And if you click the chevron, it'll expand out. If you want to see a huge expansion, load up a browser and load up about a dozen or two dozen tabs and then expand it. You'll see that each tab actually gets its own process list. So if you click the chevron to expand, you'll get more information. In this case, we're actually getting under feeds. It's the search application, and it gives me the command line at that point. Now, that one there, command line, well, looks like it makes sense, sort of. I don't know, C Windows System Apps, Microsoft Windows.Search, dot, you know, random stuff. It doesn't look terribly suspicious, so I probably would trust that. But there's another thing that you can actually do on the next build. If you want to investigate it further, right-click on it, and you'll have an option there to search online. And in true Microsoft fashion, well, not in true Microsoft fashion, they actually loaded in the default browser, which in my case was Chrome, but they do use Microsoft Bing to search for information about that particular process. And I can see in here that the results say the true searchapp.exe is a safe Microsoft Windows system process. So that makes me feel good. Except, it goes on to say, next. However, writers of malware programs such as viruses, worms, Trojans deliberately give their processes the same file name to escape detection. So that doesn't give me real warm fuzzies. But given the command line where it's loading from, again, it looks like it sort of makes sense, and I would think that that is probably okay. So I have 149 background processes to go. Next. We've looked at three. Next. So we got 146 to go. So is this a good intellectual exercise? I think it is. I mean, it is interesting to see what is running on your computer. Validate some of the things that, you know, investigate further on things that look suspicious or you don't understand or things like that. Sure, it's a great exercise to actually go through this. Is it tedious? For sure. 149 background processes running on my computer. And I don't think my computer is necessarily, you know, unusual in that regard. Is it likely to find a keylogger? Well, maybe. I don't know. If there is one installed on my computer, that would be one way that I could actually track it down, but it would be really, really tedious to actually find it that way. Quite frankly, I would count more on antivirus programs, especially being able to run a number of on-demand antivirus programs to try to track it down that way. So if anybody has other information, I see something from Tom. He says you can download bootable AV programs to run from CD or USB. Yep. The other thing that in terms of the update, usually if I'm going to run one of those bootable AV programs, I will download it fresh from the vendor just before I want to use it, and that way it'll already be up to date. And you don't have to worry about trying to connect to your Wi-Fi from, you know, the bootable CD or USB flash drive or whatever. And Tom says Process Explorer can check out versus VirusTotal. Yeah, that's a good point. So Process Explorer, which is part of the sysinternals, which now with Microsoft, it's got a column in there where you can actually have it go out and check every process that's running on your computer. Check it out at VirusTotal, where it'll be scanned against about 50 or 60 different antivirus programs with up-to-date antivirus. So that's actually really, really good use of Process Explorer for sure. Free program. If you just do a search on sysinternals, it'll pop up as the first hit, I think.
A couple of early comments too, Chris. Tim was talking about scammers and pointed out that scammers have already started with false information about rebates of license plates. And if anybody hasn't heard, your vehicle registration license fee will be rebated, but it will come to you as a check in the mail. So don't
click on any link. Yeah, it's automatic. Automatic, you don't have to do anything. Yeah.
Yeah, don't click on any link. And Tom also said that some malware copies the clipboard as it changes.
Okay. Interesting.
Elizabeth has asked about examples of on-demand antivirus, but you gave a whole list of those.
Yeah, and there's more. I mean, those are just the ones that I was willing to spend some time to validate that they were on-demand scanners and not on-access scanners. So there's more out there.
And Elizabeth says she's always been puzzled about how to make sense out of Task Manager.
Yeah, it's a very useful tool, not only for things like this, but for performance investigations. If your computer's bogging down, seeing if it's something that is using too much CPU, is it using too much disk, is it using too much memory, are you running into memory difficulties because, you know, you're at 90% memory utilization and things like that. I give a lecture on Windows performance tuning, and it depends heavily on using Task Manager for as well as resource it's not called monitor, resource something, resource monitor and task manager. So it's a very, very useful program for sure. Takes a little bit to figure it out, but it's definitely worthwhile. And it's all on every computer, so why not?
Josh is asking, what does the green leaf symbol mean?
Somebody else could probably answer that definitively. I think it might be that it's a store app, but I'm not sure about that. If anybody knows what that green leaf is, I found it by doing Google search, so I'm sure that it'll pop up pretty easily if you ask for, you know, green leaf in Task Manager or something like that. I imagine it'll pop up.
Okay, good. Thanks very much, Chris. That's really good.
Okay.
The next item is I have a little thing here. I call it Tall Tales. Chris and I are really big on making disk image backups, and I've been doing these for years. And in fact, this happened because a friend of mine fell for the Microsoft Tech scam and gave remote access to the scammer on her computer. So basically, I needed to rebuild her computer from scratch. Well, it turned out that I had made a disk image of her whole system. However, the problem was I made the image in 2016 when she first obtained the machine, and of course, she never updated it. But the neat thing about the image was that it also included an installed version of Microsoft Office. And of course, the other thing she couldn't find was the installation software for Office. So by restoring the image, I thought, I'll just restore the image, I'll get the whole operating system and the applications back again, and then I'll just run Windows Update and leave it running and it'll be fine. Well, Windows Update stopped at version 15.11 because Windows, that version had reached end of service. So that meant going onto the web and finding that there was a Windows 10 upgrade package, which I then installed, and that got me to version 17.09. And then running Windows Update again, suddenly it freezes on this KB number. And of course, the one thing I tried was to run the Update Troubleshooter, and Troubleshooter Word and flash this little light, and said everything was fixed, except nothing was fixed. So now I have to go and check on Chris's Q&A posting from last January, where he went through a whole bunch of troubleshooting updates. And one of them includes running disk cleanup. So sure enough, I run disk cleanup, and it just sat there and Word on Word for hours, quite literally, it ran for hours. Does anybody know what disk cleanup is doing when it goes away into Never Never Land and takes forever to come back again? I've got no idea.
There's one thing that I know that I just read recently about it. I thought it was just deleting things that were redundant, but they say that it actually compresses some of the older updates. Now, I can't imagine that would take hours, but that would add a certain amount of time to, rather than just deleting old drivers and things that got updated and so forth, compressing them and squirreling them away again would take a little bit of extra time, but yeah, I don't know what it's doing for
hours.
That
makes no sense, Chris. I mean, you're trying to clean up and you've told it to delete all these things. Why would it compress them and store them somewhere you don't know about?
It says it deletes and compresses some. So there's some, I guess, that it figures even though you want to get rid of it, they think, well, you may really need this, I guess. I don't know.
Anyway.
I remember one time you said if you reinstall the image to different hardware, it took hours and hours and hours. Like you came back next day before it was finished, type of thing. Might be the same sort of idea.
This is the same computer.
This was on the same machine, and that idea of the fact that it took me, you know, doing restore to different hardware, it took literally several days. That still doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand it at all. And I will never, ever again do a restore to different hardware.
I mean, I find that I can make a disk image and restore an image in about 20 minutes. So
yeah,
taking hours is no good. Anyway, update ran and cleanup ran, and eventually Update got to version 20H2, And then the next day I ran update again and it finally got to 21H2, which at that time was up to date. So disk images are wonderful things, but sometimes they don't quite work out as you expect. Okay, moving along. Chris has a share on clocks, apparently.
Yeah, and yeah, I'm pasting a URL into the chat that I'll be talking about in a bit. So the normal display for Windows clock in the taskbar is that it'll show it like that, where you have hours, colon, minutes, and then AM or PM, and the date underneath it. But if you want to be a little bit more precise, you can actually do a registry hack, which will add seconds to the display. So in this case, it's 12:12:35 PM, rather than it would just normally be showing 12:12. So fairly simple to add this. The first method is to use Registry Editor, and I'm going to caution people a little bit here. I've used Registry Editors for a lot, and they, you know, the RegEdit is a fine program to use to customize things that you can't do through the Windows interface, but don't go just making random changes that you see in the registry thinking that, oh, I don't like that, I'll just change it to something else. So you can quickly end up with an unbootable computer, for sure. So, but if you follow instructions carefully, you shouldn't have a problem. So to start off, you run the registry editor. The easiest way I find is just click the start button, type in regedit, and in the best match in the program list that comes up after the search will be registry editor app, and then just click on that.
Actually, Chris, I would suggest the first step, especially if you're listening, make a backup.
Yeah, yeah. If you're at all nervous, certainly, about using registry editor, yeah, make an image backup so that you can always get back to the state your computer was in before you started the exercise. So next. So step two, you see the registry editor there, and in the left-hand pane, you see a number of registry hives. So there's five of them, and you want to expand out the HT current user, and so you click the chevron beside it to expand that area, and then you keep on expanding down, 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 next, until you get to HT current users, software, Microsoft, current version, Explorer, advanced. And then what you want to do at that point, next, is you right-click on the word advanced, and you choose new DWORD 32-bit value. And you click on that, and it'll create they'll just name it this new value number one, and it'll be already highlighted. So if you just start typing, it'll replace what is there for that name. If you accidentally click off it, click on it again and then right click on it, and you can choose rename, which will get you back that highlighted value. And you can just type in show seconds in system clock exactly as you see it. And then once you hit enter after that to commit it, then you double click that, and then you'll get a little dialog box pop up where you can set the value for that data element, and you set it to one. And then you click OK, and you close a registry editor, and you have to sign out of Windows and sign back in. You do a reboot, but if you want, you can just do a sign out and sign back in is enough to have it take effect. And at that point, you will then have seconds in your clock in your system tray. So another method is to run a reg file. And .reg files are files that when you run them, it actually is giving instructions to the registry editor. So it just does things on your behalf so you don't have to drill down, double-click, create a registry key and things like that. So it's a plain text file, and it allows you to import, change, or delete information that is in the Windows registry. Next. So the first line in a regedit file is Windows Registry Editor version 5.0. So it's just automatically in there. And then each section is going to start with a key that you want to have modified. So in this case, if you recognize that, HK current users, software, Microsoft, Windows, current version, Explorer, advanced is the key. And then below that, you can have one or more values that will be in underneath that key. So in this case, we have a value of show seconds in system clock, and the value type is dword colon, and then the value data, which is, what is it, 7 8 7 0s and a 1 would be what it is. So 8 digits of information, but it's just one at the end is what's really important. And you can have multiple value names that are in there as well. So when you double click a reg file to have it import the information, you will get a couple of prompts saying, do you really want to do this? And asking for permission. And then if you do, you'll get a message eventually saying successfully added the information to the registry. So the reg file in question, this is exactly what we'd have to do that add seconds to the taskbar clock. So registry editor, Windows registry editor version 5.0, you have the key, H concurrent user all the way down to advance, and then the value, show seconds and system clock equals dword colon 0000001. Now you can also have a reg file that would remove the seconds from the taskbar clock. Be exactly the same, except the dword value would be all zeros as opposed to ending in a one. Now you could end up typing in all of that, but if you want, we've saved you the typing. If you download this and it's in the chat window, that you can download that zip file, and it has a README file in it, which is just a little bit of instructions about what it's going to do. And there are the two reg files. So one is show seconds in taskbar clock.reg, and then hide seconds in taskbar clock.reg. So you can double click either of those to toggle back and forth between having seconds in the clock or turning off the seconds in the clock. Just remember you have to sign out of Windows and sign back in for the effect to kick in.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And I have an example of using RegEdit. If you recall last week, I think, Tom was talking about, or had put in the chat window, a comment about how to change the scroll bar size. And it requires a registry edit, and you have to go to this current user key and get down to window metrics, where you'll find a scroll height and a scroll width, which are set by default at -255. And that value can be anything between -120, which is thin, to -1500, which is thick. So just out of interest, I went into Registry Editor and I changed the scroll height and width to the upper limit, -1500, basically to see what would happen. Sign out of Windows, sign back in, and this is the before. Here's Windows Notepad or Notepad Plus Plus with Tom's original posting in the chat window with the 10 forums link to change the size of the scroll bar. And so that's what it looks like normally. And then when you increase the scroll width to 1500, it's pretty obvious that we have a much wider scroll bar all of a sudden. And Chris always complains about Microsoft not doing things, but here's a PowerPoint, and you can see that the scroll bar for the thumbnails and the scroll bar for the slides have both increased in PowerPoint according to the registry values. However, it doesn't always work. If you look at the start menu, it has absolutely no effect on the thin scroll bars there. So you may think that you're changing all the scroll bar widths, but you're really not. Microsoft knows best. And that's it for me. And now it's time for Bob to talk about online privacy. He'll be wrapping up this series with part 8, which is all about updates to the various privacy options that you have.
Okay, let me just share the screen here.
Oh, Bob, I didn't make you a co-host. Hang on a second.
Okay.
I made you a co-host, but then you disappeared and came back. Okay, you're a co-host now.
Okay, so let me try sharing the screen again.
There we go.
Okay, and you see the title thing full screen there, Chris?
Yep.
Okay, so so far on our Privacy on the Internet series, we've gone through several parts, starting with part zero, because we did a presentation just on VPNs, and I decided to do a whole series. And now we're at the end of it. This is a review of what we've covered so far, and a few slides on updates to what I've covered already, things that I've learned since I started this. We're going to look at, early on we started with what are the privacy concerns, and the basic thing is if your internet activity is pretty vanilla, then your privacy, and we covered the difference between privacy and security, your privacy might not be a big concern for you, but there are several areas where it might be. If you use Facebook and other social media a lot, there's a lot of information about you that can be gleaned. If you have skeletons from your past hidden in your closet, if you're involved in any kind of political, human rights, or protest activities, if you have health issues you don't want your employer or insurance companies to know about, if you're applying for a job at a large company or organization, and a friend of mine from high school, she makes her living going on the internet and looking into people's backgrounds for potential employers or for existing employers that want to get some dirt on you so they can fire you. If you download pirated music and movies and stuff a lot, if you go to adult websites, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, anything you don't want other people to know about you. So if any of this covers you, then you may need to take your online privacy more seriously. So what info is out there? There can be all sorts of sensitive information about you floating around on the web. The information brokers and the various companies don't normally sell your social insurance number or health records or bank account numbers, but your full name, telephone number, education history, and your address is out there pretty much. If hackers have gotten into your onto your computer or into some of the accounts that you have, your bank account number and login details and your social insurance number may be out there, as well as your health insurance and other health data and all sorts of other stuff. In general, for just about anybody, all the searches you've ever made, all the websites you've visited, what websites and what pages in those sites you visited frequently is all out there for various companies to use. They know all your contacts, all your friends, all your acquaintances. They know who you send and receive emails from. They may even know the details of the emails. They know what you bought, what you've looked at, and what's on your wish list, and everything that you or your friends have posted about you on social media. As mentioned before, any involvement you've had in political, human rights, or protest activities is fair game. Old forum posts or old blogs you might have made years ago that might be embarrassing now or who don't reflect who you are now are all out there. Yeah, any old drunken party or nude photos are out there, and things you don't want your current or prospective employers to see. Now, the threats of living online is that many companies, especially giants like Google, Amazon, Facebook, they all want you to live your life online as much as possible, so that gets them as much information about you as possible. These companies get a significant amount, if not most of their income, by selling your personal information to advertisers, insurance companies, potential employers, data collection companies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the number one threat to privacy, as opposed to security, is Google. And now they go under the title of Alphabet as the name for their whole company, and then Google just a brand of some of their products. And Google doesn't just include the Chrome browser and Gmail. They also own the Android operating system that's on your smartphone, tablet, or Chromebook. There's all the other Google products like Home, Maps, Calendar, Images, Earth, Street View, Translate, Drive, Play, et cetera, et cetera. And they also own properties like YouTube, Motorola Mobility, Nest, DoubleClick, Fitbit, and all sorts of other things. Probably the number two threat is Amazon. They make most of their money by selling you stuff, but they also collect and will sell some of the data about you through areas like they get data through their Alexa, Echo, Ring, Wise, smart home products, their e-commerce marketplace, because they act as a middleman for several other online companies. They get all sorts of information from what e-books you're reading, where you are in the e-book, and everything through their Kindle e-readers and Kindle computer apps. They also own Audible audiobooks. They have their video and music platforms, including Amazon Music and the Prime Video. They sell a whole bunch of different home security cameras that are linked to the internet. They have fitness trackers and all sorts of other wonderful things. Another huge big threat is social media. The biggest threat is Facebook, and now they're under this umbrella called Meta. And this includes Instagram, Messenger, WhatsApp, and a bunch of other stuff. Other major social media players include WeChat, TikTok, which is known as Douyin in China, and a whole list of others in there. And regardless of your privacy settings, not much of what you do on social media is confidential. Another threat is the search engines. Google and Bing and Yahoo will sell information on what you've been looking at, what websites you go to, what you click through. And there's other search engines that are country specific. Now we have DuckDuckGo, which is probably the 800-pound gorilla in the privacy-focused search engine business. And there's a few other others we covered back in search engines in part three of this series. And keep in mind, if you go through part three there, you'll see that if you use DuckDuckGo properly, it gives you a lot of security. But if you use the option to go through Google for searches, well, you lose some of that. Other threats are e-commerce. Many of the e-commerce sites from Amazon and eBay all the way down to mompod.com will sell some information about you, including what you buy and what you search for to various companies. We'll cover that in a second. Microsoft, Apple, and other big IT companies, they're not really in the business of selling your personal information, but they do collect considerable info on you for various purposes. So you want to be wary of that. There's all sorts of other internet platforms out there. I'm not going to read down through the list or whatever, but includes a list of the various types of internet platforms and a couple of examples of each. And that goes all the way down to these DNA testing things like Ancestry and 23andMe that may be selling some of your information. Now, a lot of these particular companies and some of these platforms don't get into selling your personal information, but you just got to really keep an eye on, beware of the fact that what you do on the internet isn't necessarily private. One of the other threats that we covered is the data collection companies. These are companies that aggregate your data from all sorts of other sources, including some of the ones you've already mentioned, and they sell this information to advertisers so they can target their advertising to you. They sell it to insurance companies, potential employers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this can go through to some things like your government security clearance checks. Now, as well as collecting data from tracking applications and buying the data from other sources, some sites like Rakuten, which was formerly known as Ebates, and others disguise themselves as things like shopping services, price comparison services, etc. But their real purpose is to get information about you. So we also covered in some of the series parts there, what can you do about all this? Now, Tom Trache gave a really good presentation a while back that protecting your security is best done in layers. You can't depend on one particular product or type of product to do it for you. You want to have layers of security to protect you. And this, the same goes for privacy. You really need a layered approach to guard your privacy as best as you can. Now, if you've been on the internet since almost the beginning, there's not a lot you can do about the information that's already out there. But going forward, you can make it harder for the baddies to get any more tasty information about you. This starts with using a VPN or virtual private network, which was part zero of this series. You can also choose what browsers you use and the browser privacy settings. This is part two of the series. There's the search engines you use, which is part three. There's using anti-tracking and ad blocker software, which is part five. And then there's being aware of the threats and the ways you can be tracked, which is part four. And awareness is a really big part of it. It's keeps you wary of where you go and what you do. And if worse comes to worse, and if you need to, we covered in part seven, we covered what you can do to remove at least some of your personal data from the internet. So that concludes this series, Privacy on the Internet. Now, as I went through researching each piece of this series, I found out some extra information on stuff I already did. So let's just have a look at a couple extra slides here. The first is on VPNs, which is part one of, or part zero of the series. A VPN software creates a private encrypted connection or a tunnel between your computer, tablet, or smartphone and a remote VPN server. The server puts you on the internet in whatever geographic location the server is located in. And usually the VPN software will let you choose the server location. And these locations can be pretty much anywhere in the world. Now, a VPN can be used to access internet services not available in your location. This is a practice called geo-hopping. So if you have a Netflix account up here in Canada, and you find all Netflix USA is showing great stuff, but they won't show it on Netflix Canada, you can geo-hop to a location in the U.S. and still get to see the Netflix U.S. stuff. The other big purpose for VPNs is if you're on public Wi-Fi, like at Tim Hortons or Starbucks, in the hospital waiting room, at your car dealer service waiting room, or any other place on a remote or on public Wi-Fi. The VPN encrypts the connection from your device to the VPN server, and that prevents any others on the public Wi-Fi network from viewing what you're doing, which is particularly important, like if you're doing your banking or something. Now, up until recently, the conventional wisdom on VPNs is they're basically used for those two purposes, security on public Wi-Fi and geo-hopping. But we covered in how you can be tracked, how fingerprinting has become a very popular way of tracking you. And I put the URL at the bottom here on a good story on what fingerprinting is and how it works. And in helping to prevent fingerprinting as one of your privacy layers, the VPN has become an important tool, especially if you use it in combination with privacy-oriented browsers and anti-tracking tools. And all this helps disguise who you are and cover up your fingerprints. This is particularly true if you use advanced VPN features like multi-hop, split tunneling, and Tor connections, and that's all covered back in part zero. Now, several websites I found over the years have had problems if you're trying to access them using a VPN, and these have included ones like Costco, Canadian Tire, Home Depot, and Loblaws. Now, most of these sites have finally learned in the last little while how to function properly if you're using a VPN, because as more and more people use VPNs, it became an issue with them. Now, there's other sites, and especially the sites that you access through an app such as iTunes, that can still be a problem. So if you have an iTunes account and you want to go there and play your songs or buy some more songs, you basically have to turn your VPN off. Now, I've used two different VPNs quite a bit. One is NordVPN. Any VPN comes up with a little bit of a speed problem there. It slows your internet access down a little bit. The NordVPN does the best job at not having too much of a speed penalty on it. The other one I've used quite a bit is Avast SecureLine VPN. And I got this as part of a big package with all sorts of other Avast products. Because if you use the paid-for Avast Premium Security, which is a great antivirus and security package, for about 50% more than you pay for a single license of Avast Security, you can get a 10 device license that also covers the Avast SecureLine VPN, their secure browser, their anti-tracking software, and whatever. And they call this package, it used to be called Avast Ultimate. Now it's called Avast One. And so the Avast SecureLine VPN, well, it's a bit slower than the NordVPN, is better integrated into all the rest as a package to help prevent the fingerprinting and other issues. So it's a six of one, half dozen of the other. If you're doing a lot of streaming of movies and songs and all that, and you want to minimize your speed penalties, the NordVPN is the best one to use. If you're going to your banking sites or other things and you want to cover everything up really well, the Avast SecureLine VPN is probably the best to use in conjunction with all their other problems or other products. Another thing I found out as I was going through doing the research is you get the things called CAPTCHAs. And you've seen those, you know, you try and get to a website and They show you a picture with all sorts of letters and numbers that are all squigglied up so the robot can't read them. Or in other cases, you have to, there's a whole bunch of squares there with pictures, and you have to pick out which squares have something like a motorcycle or a traffic light or a boat or something in them. But in the last while, all you get is a box that says, I am not a robot, and you click off the box. So how does the box know you're not a robot? There's a process called reCAPTCHA, and it starts as soon as you get onto the website to try and get onto it. It starts gathering data long before you ever check the box. And through tracking processes like those that do the fingerprinting, it tracks things like your computer mouse pointer movements, and it compares them against profiles of human activities. It'll measure the elapsed time as the mouse approaches the box, and it does a whole bunch of analysis behind the scenes to make sure it's running inside an actual browser and isn't actually a robot, and that the browser's user interface is behaving like a person is running it. For example, if a robot is moving the mouse pointer to click the box, it'll go straight to the mouse pointer at a single speed and stop exactly. Whereas if it's a person, the mouse pointer will slow down as it approaches the box. So it's not the box check that actually tells reCAPTCHA that the user isn't a bot. It's all this analysis activity and behavior before you even check the box. And that's pretty much it. That's the end of the series for now. And in answer to Alan's previous request because the cupboard is bare, I'm chewing over doing a mini series on things like downloading video and audio off things like YouTube, and how to use screen capture software to get videos and audios from sites that don't want you to download it. And won't be ready for next week, but we'll get to that sooner, if not later. And let me stop the share here. Oh.
We already did. Thanks very much, Bob. That's great. Okay, one more question that came in a few days ago. The question is about using virtual phone numbers using Google Voice, and the interest is in using it for when you're selling or buying something online, and you need to contact the other person that's involved by text message, but you don't want to use your regular telephone number. And this individual is interested in anybody's opinion or experience with Google Voice, or using virtual numbers in general. Now, personally, I've never used Google Voice. If anybody here has specific information about Google Voice, shout out. But while you're thinking about it, I'll just mention a similar service that I have used, which is Fongo. It's an Android app. They call it Talk and Text Freely. It's a bit of a misleading statement. You get a local Canadian phone number, so it's a different number than your regular number. You get unlimited calling across Canada. You get unlimited incoming calls internationally and unlimited incoming text messaging. You get free outgoing calls and texts to other Fongo users. So that's the Talk and Text Freely. You can call or text anybody else who's using Fongo. But the red things are the cons. And if you want to send a text, then you need a subscription, a paid subscription. And similarly, if you want to call internationally, you have to have an account and you have to have credits. But they do provide fairly low rates. Because you have a local Canadian phone number, if you're outside of the country and you want to call back to Canada, you can call back for free because you're calling using a local Canada number. I guess you can phone anywhere in Canada, so cross Canada calling. And you get all kinds of features that sometimes you have to pay for, like caller ID and conferences and that kind of stuff. One thing I have found with Bongo is because it's a VoIP system, a voice over the internet, the call quality, and in particular the call stability, is not always reliable. I've had it run for an hour while I've been talking to somebody, which is much better than paying 30 cents a minute for airtime. But I've also had it where it drops the call after 2 minutes and then I have to reinitiate the call. So it can be a really good thing, and it may not be. I see Bob Harris likes Fongo, and so there's another vote for Fongo. Nobody's kicking in with Google Voice, but if you have anything on that, then let us know in the let us know by email.
Yeah, we're running over. Bob Walker here. A while back, I gave a presentation on VoIP telephones, and Fongo makes a pretty good adapter, so you can plug your existing home phone network or home phone wireless base station into it, and have it replace your ordinary landline telephones. I use another one called Uma, the problems you noted with VoIP are there, but compared to my rural Bell landline that I had before, that I was paying $50 a month for, with quality so bad I had to tell my a lot of my friends to hang up and call me back on my cell. The Uma one, and I think the rates for Fongo are similar. For $5 a month, I get all sorts of calling features, including caller ID. I get free long distance in the U.S. and Canada, and very cheap long distance rates anywhere else in the world. So if I'm talking to anybody anywhere else in the world, I use WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger. So, Fongo has a great service there.
And Tom just put a posting in the chat about Free Phone Line, which is a Canadian company, so you might want to check that out too. Okay, so we don't really have time for questions. We're about 10 minutes over the hour here. So I'll just remind you in the chat that we need questions and shares for next week. Not next week, for the 16th. Because next week, Lawrence, do you want to say anything about your presentation on Teams? That's putting Lawrence on the spot. He never thought about that.
No, not at this stage. I'm just... It was an interesting research topic. Let's just say that. So, anyways, we'll have as much as I can say that I think is going to be of interest to everyone that typically attends, as to why they even want to consider Teams free as an option. So, stay tuned.
That's for all the Microsoft fans, right? Thanks, Lawrence. We look forward to your presentation.
Alan, come on now. Teams is there's a Teams version set up for Linux, and I'm using it quite happily, well, most of the time, on my Chromebook. So there's that.
All right, we'll look forward to your presentation. And here's a special presentation being offered by Linda. Linda's still with us?
Yes, I am. So thanks very much, Alan. Yeah, just to let people know that you all know I write this monthly column for OPCUG on photography. So I'm going to do a virtual travel presentation on Tuesday, March 15th at 7 p.m. Ottawa time. My presentation will probably only be about a half hour, and then there'll be time to, you know, share travel experiences or photography tips. I'll be pointing out a few tips as I go along the presentation, but it's mostly just a fun virtual trip down the Danube. And so the Zoom link is there, and I think someone might have put it in the chat, but if you have any questions, you can write me.
Yeah, the URL is in the chat along with Linda's email address.
Great, thanks, Chris.
And the slide will be in the posting on the website, so all the information will be available. Okay, I just remind you about our Tech Talks series, and the first one is on April the 4th, our spring cleanup session, with all these good things that we're going to talk about. Free for club members, $20 for non-members, which includes a one-year membership. But if you want to attend, you have to register because we're charging non-members. We'll be giving out the link to people who have registered. Final slide. No Q&A next week because March the 9th is our meeting, our regular monthly meeting. And as you know, Lawrence is going to be talking about Teams. So you've got lots of time to send in your questions and your shares and computer basics topics to suggestion box in time for our next Q&A, which will be in 2 weeks on Wednesday, March the 16th. And there you go. We're 10 minutes over or so. So sorry about that. Thanks for attending and have a good night.
Thanks much, folks. We'll see you next week at the general meeting and in 2 weeks at Q&A.